Welcome to This Week in Amateur Radio. This is the full version of edition number 664, with a release date of December 31st, 2005.
Here are the stories making news this week in amateur radio.
The FCC says emergency responders need spectrum for mobile broadband access. The ARRL says that response to BPL complaints are an illusion of resolution. The BPL battle goes on as one provider in Australia denies their BPL system causes any interference. A massive BPL installation is planned for 2006 in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Canadian amateurs may lose the 220 to 222 MHz band in the new year. Nominations are sought for the 2006 Dayton Hamvention Awards. Hams in the United Kingdom will begin 2006 with a totally new band plan. Echolink's Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD, will speak worldwide on the missing link system. The crew of the International Space Station sends the world holiday greetings from space. And to further jump ahead of terrestrial radio, one satellite provider in North America will begin transmitting in 5.1 surround sound. We'll have all the details. These stories come to you in a moment, along with our regular features. Vern Jackson, WA0RCR, with the latest on upcoming contests and conventions on the Gateway 160-meter net report. Chris Peterson, KG0BP, will have the latest edition of the Space Report. Pat Tice, WA0TDA, will have a brand new update from the Courage Handy Ham Center. Leo Laporte will be here with all the latest technology news and commentary. Bill Barron, N2FNH, will be here with another random access thought. Bruce Page, KK5DO, will have another update on his column on working amateur radio satellites. And this week, we feature Bill Continelli, W2XOY, who will take a look back at some of amateur radio's fallen flags. That's all ahead on edition number 664 of North America's premier amateur radio news magazine of the air, This Week in Amateur Radio. Reporting from our Midwest News Bureau at the CBC in Chicago, I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ.
And reporting from the city that never sleeps, I'm Mark Phillips, G7LTT.
Reporting from our Northeast News Bureau in Rochester, New York, I'm Paul Kalacki, K2FX.
And reporting from our News Bureau in New Brunswick, Canada, I'm Brent Taylor, VE1JH.
30 minutes of solid amateur radio news begins now.
Last week, the FCC sent Congress a report on the study to assess the short-term and long-term needs for allocations of additional portions of the electromagnetic spectrum for federal, state, and local emergency response providers. At the top of the list, the study found emergency response providers would benefit from the development of an integrated, interoperable, nationwide network capable of delivering broadband services throughout the country. As a result, the report said the FCC would expeditiously examine whether certain channels within the current allocation of 24 MHz of public safety spectrum in the 700 MHz band could be modified to accommodate broadband communications. The FCC report stated, while the effort to address the short-term spectrum needs of public safety is underway, attaining a wholesale assessment of long-term spectrum needs is an ongoing task mobile broadband communications implemented in combination with upgraded equipment, associated training, and close coordination could offer emergency response providers many important capabilities. A nationwide interoperable broadband mobile communications network could provide benefits including delivery of rapid warnings and messages of criminal activity such as Amber Alerts, video surveillance during emergency incidents, real-time text messaging, and email delivery of high-resolution digital images, and the ability to obtain locations and status information of personnel and equipment in the field. The FCC envisions a mobile and satellite component in the network that would give emergency response providers the ability to bring in a mobile infrastructure and quickly reestablish communications when permanent networks are down. The network could use inflatable antennas, cell towers on wheels, and high-altitude balloons operating independently of damaged local infrastructure. Smart radios capable of operating on multiple frequencies and multiple formats would allow responders with different systems to communicate with each other. The study found that there may be a place for commercial wireless providers to assist public safety in securing and protecting the homeland. It also emphasized its long-standing commitment to work closely with the public service community to satisfy immediate and short-term spectrum needs. Appendix D outlines projects to enhance capabilities of emergency response providers. These include a citywide broadband wireless system in Washington, D.C., a statewide digital trunked network in New York with both voice and data capability, and a statewide program using MSV's mobile satellite service to enhance New Mexico State Police communications in remote and rural parts of the state. One of the most interesting projects was proposed by consulting firm Interoperable Wireless. It would use Los Angeles County as the site for its proposed National Spectrum Efficiency Demonstration System, SEDS. Interoperable Wireless said the firm's spectrum efficiency techniques can be combined to compress 80 megahertz of public safety voice services into only 8 megahertz, opening up 40 to 50 megahertz of current VHF-UHF spectrum for high-speed data services. Interoperable Wireless noted this is far more than the 12 megahertz currently allocated for public safety use in the 700 megahertz band. This is only one portion of the 72-page report. There is a wealth of information in the report on the spectrum needs of public safety agencies, including microwave frequencies for video surveillance.
In a strongly worded letter to the FCC, the League has once again asked the Commission to shut down the Manassas, Virginia BPL system because it's still causing harmful interference to amateur radio and otherwise does not comply with FCC Part 15 rules. Rick Lindquist, N1RL, from League Headquarters, has more.
The December 19th letter from ARRL General Counsel Chris Imlay, W3KD, was in response to a November 30th letter from FCC Spectrum Enforcement Division Chief Joseph Casey. Casey suggested the answer was further cooperation between the complaining radio amateurs and the city-owned BPL system. Imlay said more meetings and discussions about ongoing interference are no longer productive, while what he called this hopelessly flawed BPL system is allowed to continue operating. Rather than producing a solution to the interference problem, the meetings have instead created the illusion that the problem is being addressed, Imlay wrote. Ham radio complaints of interference from the BPL system date back to early 2004. Previous meetings between the complaining radio amateurs and the BPL operator produced no measurable results, Imlay contended. Communication Technologies, ComTech, operates the BPL system over the municipally owned electric power grid using main.net equipment on frequencies between 4 and 30 megahertz. The League accused the FCC of not discharging its most fundamental obligation to prevent or resolve interference. It charged that the Manassas system only remains operating, quoting now, because the Commission, for political reasons, has consistently refused to enforce its rules with respect to BPL, end quote. The League told Casey that the only solution at this point is to order the Manassas BPL system to cease operation, except for interference tests. Imlay says ComTech and the City of Manassas have openly acknowledged interference to amateur stations, but claimed that until recently they were unable to notch amateur allocations because they didn't yet have the equipment to do so. Reporting from ARRL headquarters in Newington, Connecticut, I'm Rick Lindquist, N1RL.
Previous meetings between the complaining radio amateurs and the BPL operator produced no measurable results, Imlay contended, referring to the response of Donald Blasdell, W4HJL, to Casey on December 9. At one point, the system interference was reported at S9 plus 40 dB on a typical ham receiver. That level precludes virtually all amateur radio communications, he asserted. Imlay took the opportunity to again point out that the Manassas BPL system is out of compliance with the Section 15.615 subpart A because its operator failed to provide full information to the public BPL database by November 19 deadline. ARRL again requests that the BPL facility at Manassas, Virginia, be instructed to shut down immediately, the League's letter concluded, and that it not resume operation unless the entire facility is shown to be in full compliance with the Commission rules regarding radiated emissions, with the non-interference requirement of Section 15.5 of the Commission's rules, and not in any case until 30 days subsequent to full compliance with Section 15.615 subpart A of the rules. Field tests conducted by Manassas radio amateurs established that the city's BPL system was an interference generator at distances of hundreds of feet from the modems on overhead power lines, the ARRL told the FCC October 13. It was also, incidentally, determined that the power system was susceptible to interference from nearby radio transmitters operating between 4 and 20 megahertz, the league added.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, you are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wokey Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
Newspapers in Dallas, Texas are reporting that broadband over power line internet access will be coming to the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex area in 2006. A subsidiary of the energy provider TXU Corporation announced a 10-year, $150 million deal this week to build a smart power grid that will make high-speed service available using power distribution lines available to millions of its customers. Construction on the smart grid system will begin early next year along TXU's 14,000 miles of transmission and 100,000 miles of distribution lines. Residential internet service is expected to start up in the second half of 2006. While internet access will be a major part of the business scheme, TXU Energy Delivery spokesman Chris Sheehan says that BPL is actually secondary to the overall smart grid capabilities. He says that once completed, the grid will let the company check meter consumption remotely and pinpoint problems before they become major blackouts. Proponents of the plan say BPL could be especially significant for rural areas where traditional broadband access has lagged. Opponents fear that it will cause massive interference to all radio communications on the high-frequency bands because the power lines will act as gigantic radio antennas to transmit the BPL signal as unwanted noise and interference to nearby radio receivers. The only bright spot for ham radio was the decision by TXU to drop Amperon-based BPL and going with Current's gear and technology. Current's BPL deployment in Cincinnati has so far caused very few problems for the amateurs in that community.
The Canadian Amateur Service will lose access to 220 to 222 MHz on January 25, 2006. It looks like this will happen over the objections of Radio Amateurs of Canada, that nation's National Ham Radio Society. According to Canadian Gazette Notice DGTP-004-05, the Department of Industry received strong support for this change following extensive industry debate. Hams here in the US lost the use of 220 to 222 megs portion of the 1.3 meter band almost two decades ago.
The ongoing battle between amateur radio and BPL operators continues not only here in North America, but down under in Tasmania. The electrical service supplier is denying that its BPL system is responsible for any interference. From Spectrum News in Tasmania, here is Trevor Tague, VK4BAT, with the details.
BPL interference, the battle continues. Tasmania, and we've already heard reports from Burnie, that strong interference has been heard along Malunga Drive, and amateurs are keeping a close ear and eye on activities. Conrad, VK7HCK, even invited technical representatives from Aurora Energy into his home to experience firsthand the level of interference he has to put up with. Conrad demonstrated to the Aurora engineer and technician the interference across the HF amateur bands, showing them the S9 plus noise levels experienced. To prove it was BPL, Conrad also showed them the spectrogram of the interference using the Spectran, which showed the regular carrier pattern across the spectrum being monitored. What was their reaction, I hear you ask? The Aurora engineer denied that the interference was caused by BPL, even after being shown the spectrogram of regular carriers. Suffice to say, the meeting ended abruptly after this. The matter was put in the hands of the ACMA, and it's understood that a representative from the ACMA took another round of measurements a day after the Aurora meeting. For the WIA National News Service, I'm Trevor, VK4BAT.
No word yet from the ACA on what the regulatory agency found or what action they might take against Aurora Energy. BPL is also causing problems for hams in Austria. Here is Alan Duffy from Australia's Q News service with more.
In Austria, broadband services via PLC are being provided in one region, approximately 250,000 inhabitants. Since the first trials of this technology in this region, which commenced in 2001, the radio amateurs and various public safety organisations using radio services in the HF band in this region periodically reported disturbances in the frequency bands below 30 MHz, which were, according to the opinion of the spectrum users, caused by PLC operation in the concerned region. In order to verify the complaints of the various spectrum users, the competent Austrian authority, that is the Federal Ministry for Transport, Innovation and Technology, Telecommunications Authority, investigated the reported disturbances. The measurements carried out in May 2004, April 2005 and November 2005 clearly showed that the cause of the disturbance reported by users of the HF band in the concerned region is the operation of PLC. In particular, the measurements proved that the emissions of the PLC installations is up to 16,000 times, or 42 dB, higher than the relevant limit, according to CEPT ECC REC 0504. Details of the measurement results are available in the annex to the document. Analysis of Figure 2 of the report shows reported field strengths of 70 dB microvolts per metre, 65 dB microvolts per metre, and 60 dB microvolts per metre on the 80, 40 and 20 metre bands. These field strengths should be expected to result in signal levels of S9 plus 28 dB, S9 plus 17 dB, and S9 plus 6 dB in a 2 kHz wide SSB receiver on 80, 40 and 20 metre bands using a dipole at 10 metres from the power lines. Are you ready for BPL enablement of your home and neighbourhood? I'm Alan Duffy on VK1 Weblog.
If you're waiting for your vanity call sign application to be processed, listen up. The FCC has announced that the routine processing of amateur radio vanity call sign applications will resume on Wednesday, January 4th. With more details, here's Amateur Radio Newsline's Bruce Tennant, K6PZW.
According to a report in the ARRL letter, the FCC's Wireless Telecommunications Bureau suspended vanity processing in September. This as an indirect result of its hurricane-related extensions of certain regulatory and filing deadlines. Earlier in 2005, the FCC announced it would extend filing and regulatory deadlines for licensees in parts of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, and Florida directly affected by hurricanes Katrina, Rita, and Wilma. During the extension periods, the Bureau temporarily suspended certain automated licensing functions. These included dismissing applications that are returned and not amended on a timely basis, changing the status of a call sign from active to expired if a license is not renewed within the 2-year grace period for amateur radio licensees, and issuing vanity call signs. In September, the FCC said it had to suspend routine vanity call sign processing because the extensions included the 2-year grace period and could conceivably affect the vanity program. It has been that way ever since. And I'm Bruce Tennant, K6PZW in Los Angeles.
The Commission said licensees or applicants needing relief beyond the initial extension period should follow the process for submitting waiver requests provided in Section 1.925 of the Commission's rules.
The International Earth Rotation and Reference System Service has announced the introduction of a time step at the end of December to add a leap second as 2006 arrives. Leap seconds are needed to keep clocks in step with Earth's rotation, which varies by several thousandths of a second per day. Slowing down the clocks every year or two keeps them in sync. As 2005 transitions to 2006, Coordinated Universal Time will be retarded by 1 second. This essentially means that the last minute in 2005 will be 61 seconds long. December 31, 2005, 23:59:59, December 31, 2005, 23:59:60, January 1, 2006, 00:00:00. This adjustment will affect UTC and all timescales based on UTC. Loran C and GPS will not be adjusted physically, however. Times of coincidence for Loran C are available on the Time Service webpage. For GPS, the leap second correction contained within the UTC data of the navigation message transmitted by satellites will change. After the leap second, GPS will be ahead of UTC by 14 seconds.
Transmission and production expenses for today's edition of This Week in Amateur Radio was made possible by our staff and crew at our headquarters in Albany, New York. Remember that out-of-pocket expenses to cover production of this weekly bulletin service by our staff is a limited resource. If you value our service to keep you up to date on all the latest amateur radio news, please help support us. Although we can't tell you how to support us on the air, you'll find all the information you need at our website at twiar.org. That's www.twiar.org.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, you are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wolke Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
Produced by amateurs, for amateurs, and originating from Albany, New York, you're listening to This Week in Amateur Radio.
What a wonderful place to spend Christmas. That was the word this week from Expedition 12 Commander Bill MacArthur, KC-5ACR, and his crewmate and flight engineer, Valery Tokarev, on the International Space Station. Wearing Santa hats, the astronaut and the cosmonaut extend Christmas and New Year's greetings to everyone on Earth.
Hi, I'm Bill MacArthur, commander of Expedition 12 on the International Space Station, and along with my crewmate, Valery Tokarev, Soyuz commander and station flight engineer, we'd like to welcome you on board the International Space Station, and thank you for helping us celebrate Christmas. For me, Christmas has always been perhaps my favorite time of the year, and I think that is particularly true for two reasons. One, because of the very significant religious meaning behind the celebration of Christmas, and also because it's a time in which my family has always gathered together. And so for me, this will be perhaps the time in which being away from my family will be the most stressful and the most significant, but at the same time, what a wonderful place to spend Christmas.
Hi, I am Valery Tokarev, I am flight engineer. Welcome on the board of the International Space Station. I want to say that it's probably unique New Year for us with Bill MacArthur to meet the New Year and Christmas Eve on the board of the space station. I want to say that majority of the people in Russia celebrate a holiday, New Year and Christmas Eve, because it's just very important. Not only religious, it's very important for people because we finish 1 year and just start to next. I want to say not so many years for each of us during our life. And I wish you all the best in New Year's and Merry Christmas.
As we look down on the earth, especially during this time of year, where it really brings home, it really strikes us how fortunate mankind is to live on such a wonderful, beautiful planet. And also we realize that we have great responsibilities as stewards of this planet, that it is our home, it is our one home planet, and it's something that we certainly have an obligation to care for. So from on board the International Space Station, Valery and I would like to wish you a very Merry Christmas and a happy and prosperous New Year.
MacArthur and Tokarev will return to Earth in April.
The Southgate Amateur Radio webpage is reporting that hams in Great Britain will ring in 2006 with some new band plans that will place strict regulation on the introduction of fully automatic digital communications techniques. The new band plans may also hamper growth of current automated robot digital operations by defining where on any given band they can and cannot be. While it hardly ever uses the word digital, it does refer to such things as automatically controlled data stations and defining available spectrum. For example, on 40 meters, automatic stations are confined from 7.040 to 7.043 megahertz for a total of 3 kilohertz of operating space. On 20 meters, automated data stations are given from 14.089 to 14.099 and 14.101 to 14.112 megahertz, depending on the signal's actual spectrum used by the signal. In all, automated operation is very carefully defined by specific spectrum and signal bandwidth for each high-frequency band where it will be permitted. On the VHF bands, there were very few changes except for enlarging the meteor scatter section of 2 meters and recognizing the use of other European nations of 12.5 kHz repeater spacing in the 70 centimeter band. Also, 70.150 MHz has been officially adopted as meteor scatter falling frequency on the Europe-only 4 meter band. Unlike the United States, which is looking at regulatory amateur radio operations by overall bandwidth, it appears that for now the UK and most of Europe is content to stay with the fine band segment to separate various modes. That said, in the introduction, the plan notes that on 10 meters and below, the maximum allowable bandwidth for any signal is 2.7 kHz, excluding full carrier AM, which has special dispensation for its water audio. The new UK plan is based on one defined by Region 1 of the International Amateur Radio Union. The entire band plan is available online in PDF format at the RSGB website.
The Dayton Hamvention is accepting nominations for its 2006 awards for Radio Amateur of the Year, Special Achievement, and Technical Excellence. The deadline for nominations is February 20, 2006. All amateur radio operators are eligible. The winners will be recognised at the 2006 Hamvention, which runs May 19 to 21. The Radio Amateur of the Year award goes to an individual who has made a long-term outstanding commitment to the advancement of amateur radio. The Technical Excellence award is for the person who has made an outstanding technical achievement in the field of amateur radio. The Special Achievement award honors someone who has made outstanding contributions to the advancement of amateur radio, usually someone who spearheaded a significant project. The Hamvention Awards Committee makes the decision on all awards based in part on the information it receives and not on the number of nominations received. Documentation that informs the Awards Committee of the candidate's accomplishments may include magazine articles, newsletters, news clippings, and even videos. Please note that these materials become the property of the Hamvention and will not be returned. Nominations are due by February 20, 2006. Additional details on these awards and a nomination form are available on the Dayton Hamvention website. Nominations are also accepted via US mail to Dayton Hamvention Awards, P.O. Box 964, Dayton, Ohio, 45401.
There is a really big event coming your way in January, and you're likely to hear it on a repeater in your own city, courtesy of the Echolink Network. What is it? Here is Amateur Radio Newsline's Tuck Miller, NZ6T, with the details.
The Missing Link, a worldwide web-based intertie system, has announced an online interview with Echolink creator Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD. The live session is slated for January 10th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Missing Link system is where ham radio and internet are united as one using Taylor's Echolink. The system is made up of multiple ham stations, including repeaters that are all interconnected to make a single global repeater. It does not matter if you are in Sumatra or downtown Cleveland. If there is a repeater or bulletin station with a high-speed internet connection, the Missing Link can bring the world of amateur radio to your backyard. For more information about this revolution in amateur radio, how to join, and more about its future plans, send an email to admin@missinglink.us, or you can visit the organization's website at www.missinglink.us. And, oh yes, the link in Missing Link is spelled L-Y-N-K. I'm Tuck Miller, NZ6T in San Diego.
In case you missed that date, it's January 10th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time for Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD's talk on the Missing Link Network about Echolink on a repeater near you.
Digital ham radio appears to be headed into space. AMSAT Germany's board of directors has made the decision to fly the software-defined, or SDX, transponder on their Phase 3E Express spacecraft. According to the AMSAT News Service, the decision to fly SDX was made at a recent board meeting in Marburg, Germany. The transponder will use the space that was originally planned for the RUDAC modem module. The SDX features AMSAT North America's implementation of software-defined radio based on quadrature sampling detector technology, with the use of the SDX processor significantly improved linearity and efficiency in the UHF-VHF transponder can be achieved compared to the all-analog operations. No specific launch date for Phase 3E has been announced. We will have more ham radio space-related news later in this week's newscast.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, you are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wokey Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
You know, there's just nothing better than hot pizza, lovingly baked, over an open, defocused laser. So, who's in the mood for hot, double cheese pizza with anchovies that look like eyebrows already?
Hello, Mother Radio.
Oh, hello, Packet Man.
I have heard your call, and I am ready to consume mass quantities of pizza.
Well, go ahead, knock yourself out. I said, knock yourself out, not the entire kitchen.
Great family and friends, the best pizza and amateur radio. That's an incredible combination. And the focus of the next Random Access Thought coming up in just a few minutes right here on This Week in Amateur Radio.
In 3, 2, 1.
You ever heard the expression, how do you turn this on? Many cell phones, the first thing you do is, where's the on-off button? It's not obvious. I've been talking a little bit about this 8700 from BlackBerry that I've been playing with. There is an on-off button on the top. And I'm used to the on-off buttons being on the number pad. On many cell phones, it's the far right on the number pad. And I was looking on it. I couldn't find an on-off button. Finally, I looked, oh, the top. One thing they did that I really like, though, and I wish more people would do, this is another place where people just go crazy. Every time you buy a new device, you have to have a different power adapter, right? There's nothing... Is there a standard? There's no standard. They just... Whatever they think up. Whether it's a laptop, a cell phone, anything that needs battery power or has to be plugged in, it's a different adapter every time. It drives me nuts. You can actually buy kind of a... In many cases, not all cases, you can buy an adapter. Apple's a good example. You have to buy the Apple-style adapter. Nothing else uses that adapter. And it seems like every cell phone has something different for a connector. And what I liked about the BlackBerry 8700 is it has a USB, comes with a USB cable. And the USB cable is how you charge it. So the charger has the same exact connector. But it's a standard USB connector, which means it'll charge from your laptop. When I go on the road, you don't have to bring multiple. You bring your laptop power adapter and the USB cable, and that'll charge the phone. There's a very good market in multiple adapters for a single phone. So you get a new phone, you got to get the travel adapter, which doubles as the home adapter, the cigarette lighter adapter, right? And then a lot of people buy a laptop adapter so you can charge it from a laptop so you don't have to bring the travel adapter or the cigarette lighter adapter on the road when you travel on the airplane. It's just endless. It isn't your fault. This stuff is kooky. It is hard to use. The on-off switch isn't obvious. Don't feel bad that you can't figure it out. It's because there are no standards. And no company wants standards because they make more money if they're not standards. Why did BlackBerry do this USB thing? I don't have to buy a travel adapter. I don't have to buy a power adapter for my laptop. I don't even have to buy a car adapter because I already have a USB adapter for some other device. So they're losing money by making it standard. But you know what? They're making me happy. They're making the consumer happy. You see, there's a disconnect between the greed of many companies and consumer happiness. And I would say that they're going to have to start paying a little more attention to consumer happiness. But the key is that we stop blaming ourselves. See, as long as consumers say, oh, I must be stupid, or it's something I'm doing wrong, or, oh, well, that's just the way it is, then they never have to fix it. As long as we say, oh, well, you know, it's just me, I mustn't be bright enough, they'll never get better. User interfaces will never get better. We have to stand up and say, hey, no, this is bad. There should be a standard place for an off switch. The battery adapter, power adapter should be the same. Batteries should be the same. What is it? Why are they taking advantage of us like this? And, you know, I would be glad. I would happily fade off into the sunset if it got so easy that nobody needed any help. They could just, everybody, I mean, there is no, as far as I know, although who knows, there's no talk radio show on home appliances. Using your toaster. 12 simple ways to use your toaster better. No, you don't need one. So I think that someday it may happen, with any luck, that we get that way with personal technology. I don't have high hopes. There's some very interesting buzz going on. I'll give you one story that I think is kind of interesting. Some very interesting buzz is going on about Apple and their Intel-based Macintoshes. Everybody now, including Citigroup, the analysts at Citigroup, are saying Apple will do an Intel computer in January. It is, if you're thinking this is going to kill, I'm sure Apple hates this because it's going to kill their Christmas sales, but if you're thinking about buying a Mac, now is not the time to do it. Wait and see what happens, because it could be a big, big announcement. In fact, they're saying prices will be very low, unbelievably low, like $200 low. Apple's going to be very aggressive at getting Windows users to switch over. According to ThinkSecret, which is an Apple rumor site, Apple has sued in the past for this kind of thing, but which has often been very accurate, not always. I shouldn't say the price will be $200. They'll drop the price $200 or more, which means they'll sell these iBooks maybe at $600 or $700, which is exactly where they should be. It's exactly where they should be to compete with $600 and $700 Windows laptops. Can Apple do it? Now, and here's the next question. If you could buy a laptop from Apple that ran Windows, yeah, and also ran OS X, wouldn't you? Especially if it were well-built and high-quality and did the things people really want to do or aimed at the home user. I think this is going to be very interesting. ThinkSecret, once again, is really, I don't know, they're in the middle of a lawsuit with Apple, and yet they haven't stopped. So we will watch with great interest to see what happens. That's the kind of story that I like to cover because I think people are going into the stores right now and saying, should I buy now? Maybe not. But it's maybe a good time to wait, hold off on Macintosh, unless you have to have one. Because I think we're going to see something happen very soon. Now, we were talking about the BlackBerry. I do want to mention once again that email system, the BlackBerry email system, is in jeopardy. A judge ruled on Wednesday saying that BlackBerry, RIM, the company that makes BlackBerry, had to pay or at least had to consider the patents of a company called NTP, which claims the patents came to, I think, 11 patents on the email system that BlackBerry's use. Now, that's the key of a BlackBerry. BlackBerry is not really a cell phone company. It is about the email, the corporate email, the what they call push email, the email that just arrives in your device. And if they lost the rights to do that, it pretty much put RIM out of business. So on Wednesday, a judge said, I'm tired of this. You don't have a deal. You've got to go to a settlement hearings. It could cost RIM $1 billion. Can they afford to pay $1 billion? Will they have to go out of business? I think not. I think that there will be some way we can solve this. There are only 3.6 million BlackBerry users. That's not a huge number, but many of them are in government. Many of them are in high finance and big business, and I don't think they're going to let this happen. This is the kind of infrastructure technology that the country runs on. And it's like the steel strike in the 60s. The president ordered in troops to keep the steel mills open because the country needed steel. I think it's that close. That's that kind of a technology. I don't think that'll happen. So we shall see, but I'm sure I'd be willing to bet that some settlement will be reached.
On the podcast radio network, I am Leo Laporte. Have a wonderful weekend.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, you are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wolke Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
The program is what is known in the trade as an encore performance.
Hey, Mother Radio, isn't encore performance just a fancy way of saying it's a repeat?
Look, buddy, let's stick with the euphemism. If you haven't heard it before, then it's new to you. So, sit down, shush already, and listen carefully, and do as you're told.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, this is N2FNH, Bill Barron, at the K's Famous Pizza in Burton Lake, and I'm here with the Bowens tonight. We're having pizza and all kinds of great food, and I've got George's long-suffering wife, Cheryl, with us, who has a few comments about this week in amateur radio. Tell me, Cheryl, how many years have you been associated with This Week in Amateur? How many years have your weekends been involved with This Week in Amateur Radio?
Is it 11? It is. 11.
11 years, every weekend, every Friday, every Saturday, devoted to the cause of amateur radio. You must be a grand wife, a lovely woman.
That's correct.
You're not saying too much. You're not saying too much. Do you have any personal thoughts on the subject? Do you have anything you would like to say in regard to This Week in Amateur Radio as it relates to your family and personal life? Let your hair fall. We'll do this over. Okay, now what we really want to get from you is the true inside skinny. You know, every Friday and Saturday you give your life selflessly to the cause of amateur radio. How would you change this if you could?
Well, over the years, I've asked them to change the time. But for the majority of it, it is a little inconvenient. We usually can't do a lot of things together on a Saturday evening or something like that. But if there's something to be done, I just go up and do what I need to do. Me and the kids will go to the park. We go to the fireworks in the summer, and we do what we need to do. When we have to do things together, we plan it ahead of time.
Oh, very good. Now, I do notice that every day, you and George loyally are on the 146.94 machine, talking every day. Do you enjoy having these conversations with your husband? And do you oftentimes have conversations with other hams? In other words, have you gotten past the boyfriend-girlfriend syndrome that you sometimes see with female hams? I mean, do you find yourself actively involved in the hobby?
No.
That's a great answer. And George, to defend yourself, any comments?
No, I have no comments.
You have?
No, we've been doing it for 11 years the same way. We did move a time. We used to be at 6, I think it was, on Saturdays. But, locally now it airs at 9 o'clock. So we did move the time, like she mentioned. But for the most part, it's something that we've committed to do. And we do our best to make sure that we're hitting the satellite window at our appointed time and getting the file out on the Internet.
So this is a commitment, like the commitment of marriage
the commitment of This Week in Amateur Radio, and you are willing to hold to this bond, this holy bond of amateur radio for the rest of your life?
Well, marriage, we've been married, it'll be 20 years, and marriage is a give and take. He enjoys doing radio. I don't enjoy it as much as he does, but that's what he likes to do, and I don't want to take that away from him, just as he wouldn't take things that I like to do away from me. So if there's something that I really want to do, I just go off and do what I want to do.
Okay, would you please divorce him so I can marry you? That's great.
I will say this, though. I can probably sum it up all like this. My oldest daughter, when she was about 3 years old, this is what she thought husbands and wives did for their hobbies. One of my hobbies is cake decorating. I like to bake and do cake decorating. So when she was 3 years old, we were sitting in the car one day, and she says to me, "Mom, so dads go to work and moms go to work, but when they come home, moms do cake decorating and dads do bulletins."
Sounds correct to me. Okay. Well, my son wants to get in on the act. What is it, Zachary? What would you like to say?
Weird.
Okay, there you go. My son's critical comment for it. But before we go, Jessica, do you have any comments about This Week in Amateur Radio?
No.
No? How about Chelsea? Any comments?
No.
No, they have no comments whatsoever. There you go. This is Bill Barron into FNH for the Random Access Thought.
By the way.
Oh, there's more.
Yes. I wanted to mention, because George won't mention it, tomorrow George will be doing bulletins on his birthday. That is how he will be celebrating his birthday, bringing amateur radio to you, rather than having a party.
Rephrase that. I want that right. No, I don't want this part up.
Here goes the give and take in a marriage. Amateur radio news.
Amateur radio news.
Amateur radio news.
And I'll be 26 in October.
Come back!
This is Bill Barron.
Say connecting to the Random Access Thought.
No.
You lousy bum.
N to F and H.
Disconnecting from... the Random Access Thought.
The second Sunday in January is the day to turn your shack over to the kids for some ham radio fun with a purpose. To tell us more about the special Kids Day operating event, here is Rick Lindquist, N1RL, from the ARRL Audio News.
The first running of Kids Day 2006 begins Sunday, January 8th at 1800 UTC and continues until 2400 UTC with no limit on operating time. The second Kids Day, by the way, will be Saturday, June 17th. Kids Day provides a terrific opportunity to show youngsters what amateur radio is all about, and that includes its role in emergency communication. ARRL Education and Technology Program, the Big Project Coordinator, Mark Spencer, WA8SME, says Kids Day can be a great opportunity to spark change and get kids and families thinking about emergency preparedness. While you're coaching the youngsters who visit your shack and their parents, too, on how to make contacts and new friends via ham radio during Kids Day, why not take a few moments to ask them about their family's plans to deal with emergency challenges, Spencer says in December 2005 QST. Why not use the opportunities offered by Kids Day to show the youth in your neighborhood that ham radio can be loads of fun, and that ham radio is a way that they can contribute something very valuable to their communities. Call CQ Kids Day when you're on the air. The suggested exchange for Kids Day contacts is first name, age, location, and favorite color. It's okay to work the same station more than once if the operator has changed. Suggested frequencies are 14.270 to 14.300, 21380 to 21400, and 28350 to 28400. Contacts via VHF repeaters are okay, too, with permission from the repeater owner. Observe third-party traffic restrictions when making DX QSOs. All participants are eligible to receive a colorful certificate, which, Spencer says, becomes the youngster's personalized sales brochure for ham radio. Spencer believes Kids Day activities can result in a family emergency plan campaign that could save lives, and future community planners who know communication and how to communicate. Reporting from ARRL headquarters in Newington, Connecticut, I'm Rick Lindquist, N1RL.
For more information on the special Kids Day operating event, visit the ARRL website and search on Kids Day.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, you are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wolke Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
We have a few special event stations for you to follow over your holiday weekend, and the first takes place during the entire month of January. From Brant Rock, Massachusetts, the Fessenden Amateur Radio Society, whose club station is W1FRV, will be operating AA1A/BO from 0100 Zulu to 2400 Zulu every day during the month of January. To celebrate the 100th year commemoration of transoceanic two-way communications, they'll be on 18.075, 14.055, 10.118, and 7.055. For a QSL, contact raf.nesco at box 686, Brant Rock, Massachusetts, 02020. If you need more information, visit them on the web at www.radiocom.net/Fessenden. In Bethpage, New York, the Northern Long Island section in Bethpage will be operating W2V from January 7th through January 8th from 1200 Zulu to 2100 Zulu to celebrate Ham Radio University 2006, their 7th annual day of education at the ARRL New York City Long Island section convention. They'll be on 14.273 and 7.273. For a QSL, contact Phil Lewis, N2MUN, at 22 Bell Terrace West, Lindenhurst, New York, 11757. And finally this week, staying on the East Coast in Wall Township, New Jersey, the Ocean Monmouth Amateur Radio Club will be operating N2MO on January 7th through January 16th. From the historic Diana site to commemorate Project Diana, the first ever successful moon bounce experiment. They'll be on the general and novice tech subbands on 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10 meters. For a QSL, contact the Ocean Monmouth Amateur Radio Club at P.O. Box 267, Oakhurst, New Jersey, 07755.
Hi, this is Vern Jackson, WA0RCR, reporting for the Gateway 160-meter radio newsletter report. And, as always, our thanks to QST and the staff at QST for today's report. Taking a look at upcoming conventions, we have none to report on, but we do have some contests. The ARRL RTTY Roundup on RTTY takes place from 1800 Zulu, January 7th, to 2400 Zulu, January 8th, on 80 through 10 meters, using bought-out RTTY, PSK31, packet, attended operation only, and other digital modes. Categories are single-op high power, single-op low power, multi-op single transmitter high power, or multi-op single transmitter low power. Use of spotting assistance makes your station a multi-op station. Exchange for U.S. and Canadian stations will send signal reports and state or province. DX will send a signal report and serial number starting with 001. For further info, see page 101 in the January 2006 QST and page 87 in the December 2005 QST. Kids Day on phone runs from 1800 Zulu to 2400 Zulu, January 8th on 14270 to 14300 kilohertz, 21380 to 21400 and 28350 to 28400 kilohertz. Also 2 meter repeater frequencies with permission of the repeater owner. This is intended to encourage young people licensed or not, to enjoy amateur radio. It's also a chance to give hams a chance to share their station with children. Exchange is name, age, location, and favorite color. Work the same station again if the operator is changed. For further info, see page 101 in the January 2006 QST and page 45 in the December 2005 QST. The DARC 10-meter contest on CW and SSB takes place from 0900 Zulu to 1059 Zulu January 8th. On 10 meters, of course, workstations once only. Categories are single op mixed mode and single op CW. Exchange is signal report and serial number. DL stations will add the DOK code. For further info, see page 101 in the January 2006 QST, the Worldwide QRP Federation QSO Party on CW, SSB, and Digital. Runs from 0100 Zulu to 2400 Zulu, January 6th on 160 through 10 meters. Categories are single op all band, mixed only. Exchange signal reports, QRP club name or DXCC entity, member number or power. For further info, see page 101 in the January 2006 QST. The EUCW 160 meter contest on CW takes place from 2000 Zulu to 2300 Zulu, January 7th, and from 0400 Zulu to 0700 Zulu, January 8th, on 160 meters, of course. Categories are EU with high power, low power, or QRP classes. Then we have non-EU and SWL. Exchange signal reports, serial number, club name, member number, or NM for non-member. For further info, see page 101 in the January 2006 QST. The original QRP contest on CW runs from 1500 Zulu, January 7th, to 1500 Zulu, January 8th, on 80 through 20 meters. Categories are VLP, that's very low power, less than 1 watt, QRP, less than 5 watts, MP, medium power, less than 20 watts, and handmade. Now, I would assume that means using a straight key. The exchange is signal report, serial number, and category. Signal report alone is okay for non-participating stations. For further info, see page 101 in the January 2006 QST. This is Vern Jackson, WA0RCR, reporting for the Gateway 160-meter radio newsletter report from the studios of WA0RCR in Wentzville, Missouri. Until next time, wishing you and yours a safe and happy new year from the Gateway 160-meter radio newsletter.
This week's propagation forecast tells us that average daily sunspot numbers rose over 22 points this week to 71.4. An average daily solar flux was up by nearly 5 to 91.2. Not too bad, considering the predicted solar minimum is still a year away. Over the past week, geomagnetic indicators were stable, but a solar wind caused the K and A index to rise on December 27th and 28th. Sunspot and solar flux levels should remain approximately the same, perhaps slightly lower, January 1st through the 4th. Geomagnetic indicators should be slightly unsettled for today, December 30th, then quiet through December 31st to January 4th, and quiet to unsettled once again looking ahead to January 5th. Next week, we should have a look at the average sunspot numbers for the year, comparing them with past years. So far, as we go to press, it looks like the 2005 average daily sunspot number will be nearly 30% less than 2004.
The people who market the Eureka 147 digital radio technology believe the Swedish government will slow down or completely stop that country's digital radio expansion. This by ceasing to approve the installation of digital radio transmitters and curtailing the issuance of new digital licenses. According to a report in World Radio Online and credited to the World Digital Audio Broadcasting Forum, there is no national FM spectrum available in Sweden for new services. Instead, the Swedish government hopes listeners will use the internet, digital TV, and podcasting for new digital content. It has to be noted that the Swedish government has not said there's no place for digital audio broadcasting in Sweden's future, but it believes this is not the time to expand the DAB network or to consider switching off analog. Swedish broadcasters had hoped to see coverage expand from the current 35% of national digital audio broadcasting coverage.
As we have just completed another year of exciting news on satellites, we hope that 2006 will bring us just as much, if not more, good news. Looking back, we remember the few satellites that launched and failed, the few that launched became operational and then failed, and the few that launched became operational and continue to be operational. It is not a trivial task to design, build, and launch a satellite, and then you have the launcher and space to determine the future of the satellite. 2006 will bring another wave of attempts by universities and AMSATs to place more satellites in orbit. We wish them much success and the hams on the ground happiness in working these new satellites. Here's wishing you and yours a very happy and prosperous new year from all of us at AMSAT. This is Bruce Page, KK5DO.
This week in amateur radio is heard on the amateur bands around the world and all across North America on great repeater systems, including the KC8KGZ repeater on 147.260 MHz, serving the city of Flint, Michigan.
Are you ready to take another trip into amateur radio history? This is Bill Continelli, W2XOY, and I'll be back in a moment with another installment of the Ancient Amateur Archives, here on the W0KIE Satellite Network.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, you are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wolke Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
The Ancient Amateur Archives. I'm Bill Continelli, W2XOY.
In 1932, the United States was trapped in the Great Depression. The gross national product had fallen by 50%, and unemployment was 25%. Despite the bleak economic forecast, or maybe because of it, amateur radio was flourishing, with a 300% increase in the number of hams over a five-year period. It was during this time frame that two of the best-known names in amateur radio receivers, Hallicrafters and Hammerland, came into existence. In our last installment, we charted the rise and fall of Hallicrafters. Today, let's look at Hammerland. Oscar Hammerland founded the company that bears his name in 1932. His goal was to produce top-of-the-line receivers for amateur, military, and commercial use. By all accounts, he was successful. The first model was the Comet Super Pro. By the late 1930s, Hammerland introduced the HQ-120X. This was a 12-tube, 6-band, single-conversion receiver that covered 540 kilocycles to 31 megacycles. The price in 1938 was $129. With inflation, that's about $900 today. In 1939, the company created the Super Pro model SP-200, considered by many to be Hammerland's finest pre-war receiver. Hammerland's motto was, "Use the set the experts use." The SP-200 featured 16 tubes in the receiver, 2 tubes in the separate power supply, and sold for $279, or about $2,000 today. During World War II, the military, the U.S. Signal Corps, and many governmental agencies extensively used the SP-200. After the war, Hammerland introduced the HQ-129X, which was an updated and improved version of the HQ-120X. Incidentally, the X indicated that the receiver had a crystal filter. Other post-war single-conversion receivers included the HQ-140 and the HQ-150. In the Super Pro series, Hammerland's first post-war model was the SP-210, but it was the SP-600, introduced in 1950, that got everyone's attention. This was a large, solid, and expensive receiver. It contained 20 vacuum tubes, covered 540 kilocycles to 54 megacycles in six bands, weighed 100 pounds, and consumed 180 watts of power. The price in 1950 was $985, almost $5,000 today. A very low-frequency version, the SP-600VLF, sold for more than $2,000 in 1950, $300 more than a new Studebaker. The SP-600 series was produced in a variety of models until 1972 and was used extensively by the military, the FBI, the CIA, and other government and commercial organizations. The SP-600 was not designed with amateur radio in mind. That, along with a price equal to the annual net income of a typical ham, kept it from being a popular amateur receiver. Although the bulk of Hammerlin's output was general coverage receivers, they also produced ham-band-only units, such as the HQ-110, a 12-tube unit made from 1957 to 1961, and the HQ-170, a 16-tube receiver produced from 1958 to 1968. The HQ-170 covered 160 through 6 meters and was triple conversion with IFs of 30-35, 455, and 60 kilocycles. Hammerlin's last major receiver was the HQ-180, introduced in 1959. This was a very popular general coverage receiver covering 540 kilocycles to 30 megacycles. It had 17 tubes, a triple conversion design, and sold for $439 in 1959. During the 1950s and 1960s, Hammerlin went through some changes. They moved to Mars Hill, North Carolina, and tried to expand their product line beyond just receivers. They came out with some transmitters, called the HX series, and even ventured into the CB radio market with the CB23, HQ105TR, and the HQ205. The last two units were unique in the CB radio arena, as they had a built-in shortwave receiver in addition to the CB transmitter. Unfortunately, the HX series and the CB radios were not successful, and by 1969, they disappeared. By the late 1960s, Hammerlin was in trouble. Their main product was the HQ-180 and its various military and commercial derivatives. Except for the HQ-215, an all-solid-state receiver, the company ignored transistors. Hams no longer looked for tube-type receivers. They wanted transceivers and, by the early 1970s, solid-state 2-meter FM rigs. Even in the shrinking receiver-only market, Hammerlin faced stiff competition from Heathkit, Hallicrafters, Lafayette, National, Nightkit, and Allied Radio Shack, all of whom had 4 or 5 tube shortwave radios for less than $70. The cheapest receiver Hammerlin ever sold had 8 tubes and cost twice as much. During the early 1970s, Hammerlin tried one last PR blitz with friendly, folksy ads in QST, but it was hopeless. Why should the 1972 amateur spend $400 or more for a receiver when $350 bought a Tempo 1 transceiver? The writing was on the wall. Even National and Hallicrafters, with wider product lines, were on their last legs. And so, in 1972, Hammerlin pulled the plug on the HQ-180 and the SP-600 and closed up shop. The corporate assets, including the name and trademarks, were purchased by the Cardwell Capacitor Company, who also purchased the remains of National at a bankruptcy auction. But even though the company is gone, the indestructible receivers still live on. Today, thousands of enthusiasts rediscover the romance and excitement of shortwave listening with the warm, comforting glow of a Hammerlin receiver. In this day and age of scanners and other pre-programmed receivers, have we lost the art of trolling the HF frequencies for that rare and unique catch? Perhaps we need more Hammerlin receivers in the hands of amateurs. This is Bill Continelli, W2XOY, for this week in Amateur Radio.
Your time is up. Go in peace. but return again for our next installment of the Ancient Amateur Archives.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, you are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wolke Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
From the Courage Handy Hams in Golden Valley, Minnesota, this is Pat Tice, WA0TDAARL.net, reporting for This Week in Amateur Radio. D-I-L-U-T-I-O-N, dilution. Here's a concept we think we understand. If you take a half-full glass of orange juice and try sipping it, you can taste the richness of oranges. The drink is satisfying and refreshing. However, if you fill the glass to the top with water, diluting the juice, the taste will not be so rich, and the drink will be unsatisfying and bland. Sure, you could probably add a tiny amount of water and not notice much difference, but add enough water, and soon the orange juice will be tasteless and colorless. Now, let's look at the news business. When I was a young lad, there was one newspaper and two radio stations in my small Midwestern town. It was pretty clear where most people would get their news. There was a sense of common understanding, since everyone pretty much would be exposed to the same small choice of news sources. Some of the real radical news hounds would listen to shortwave radios, but they were a tiny minority. The newspaper had tremendous clout in the community, since nearly everyone subscribed to it. The two radio stations had no problems finding advertisers either. They served the city and the surrounding countryside, and nearly everyone listened to them. You could wander into the barber shop, and the local station would be playing. Today it is very different. It is almost as if the half-full glass of news has been filled to overflowing with news from everywhere and anywhere. Like the tasteless glass of watered-down orange juice, local news is washed away in a flood of ever-increasing volume. The local newspaper and radio stations now struggle since consumers are distracted by internet news, cable news, satellite radio, podcasting, and so on. Newspapers everywhere have a hard time keeping subscribers. The news business has been diluted. Across society and around the world, this phenomenon is taking place. Activities that once commanded a large audience now compete with a deluge of other choices. You can take any traditional business or leisure activity and put it to the dilution test, whether it is bowling, scouting, or selling automobiles. Amateur radio is no different, and no one should be surprised if competing activities put the pressure of dilution on it. What is our competition? It's hard to make a list, but that won't stop me from speculating. So here's what I think is giving us a real run for our money. Computing and the Internet. This is the monster gorilla of competitors, as it offers voice, instant communications via email, and the endless attic of exploration called the World Wide Web. Fortunately, hams are resourceful and have adapted the Internet to meld it successfully with radio using Echolink, IRLP, software-defined radios, digital communications, and who knows what. Still, it can be a challenge to interest newcomers in ham radio if we are perceived as old technology. Another one is the cellular phone phenomenon. Two-meter mobile communication was once the in thing for staying in touch. Now everyone and his brother is on the phone, yakking and paying scant attention to actual driving. Don't even get me started on how useless repeater auto patches have become. Then there's video gaming. This is a swirling vortex that swallows young people alive and is extremely tenacious. As any parent knows, it can be pretty difficult to pry a youngster away from the gaming console. Activities like sports, hobbies, and reading books fall prey to the vortex. Finally, there's satellite radio and television, cable TV, and portable audio and video entertainment. There are so many choices that it has become difficult to listen to all of the audio we might be interested in, or to see all the video we might want to view. This is a problem, since it results in the true gems of entertainment or information being buried in an avalanche of garbage. Don't tell me you don't wear out the TV remote looking through hundreds of channels. Of course, time spent in front of a television or listening to satellite radio is time not spent on the air with amateur radio. Of course, this is a short list, and there are a lot of other things going on as well. Schools are loading on the homework and lengthening the school year as fears of worldwide competition cause decision makers to pursue academic perfection over just allowing kids to be kids. Organized sports require soccer moms to chauffeur their children from one planned activity to the next. In this sort of pressurized environment, it is difficult for a kid to discover the magic of electronics and radio. Adults, meanwhile, are also torn between work and family, often with little discretionary time to devote to learning about amateur radio. Now, none of this means that ham radio is going away. In fact, everything under the sun will simply have to adapt to this new phenomenon of dilution. And we amateurs have been doing a pretty good job of it, with innovators taking the lead in building new technologies and integrating them with radio. My boyhood town newspaper is now on the Internet. It has had to adapt or die. We will adapt and innovate our way to the hearts and minds of the public if we want to keep ham radio vital and active. So as 2006 dawns, promise me one thing. Even if you are naturally skeptical about new technologies, say to yourself, I am going to do some reading about this new idea and ask about it at my radio club. Perhaps I will like it, and perhaps not. But at least I will have learned about something new in amateur radio. This is Pat Tice, WA0TDA at ARL.net, reporting from the Courage Handy Ham System for This Week in Amateur Radio.
The Senate this week confirmed the White House nomination of Republican Deborah T. Tate and the reappointment of Democrat Michael J. Copps to the FCC. News reports say the Senate approved the nominations of Tate and Copps by voice vote on December 21st during a late-night session. Tate, 49, most recently served as director of the Tennessee Regulatory Authority. She will fill out the remainder of the term of former FCC Chairman Michael K. Powell, which expires June 30th of 2007. Powell departed the FCC last March. A former Senate staffer, Copps, 65, has been on the commission since 2001. His new term will expire in 2010. Under Powell's successor, Chairman Kevin J. Martin, a Republican, the FCC has been operating with four members for most of 2005, and with just three members since the December 9th departure of Republican Kathleen Q. Abernathy. President George W. Bush still must fill the remaining opening on the five-member FCC with a Republican nominee to succeed Abernathy, who never was appointed to a full term. During confirmation hearings before the Senate Commerce Committee earlier this month, Tate reportedly offered few specifics on key issues facing the FCC, but touted herself as a mediator. Copps said his objective would be to help bring the best, most accessible, and cost-effective communication systems in the world to all of our people, wherever they live and whatever their status.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, you are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wolke Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
This is the Space Report for Saturday, December 29th, 2005, available as always from www.thespacereport.com. Now, reporting from Rochester, Minnesota for This Week in Amateur Radio, I'm Chris Peterson, KG0BP. The European Space Agency is basking in the success of its Huygens probe landing on the surface of Saturn's moon Titan, the Mars Express spacecraft in orbit around the red planet, Venus Express on its way to Venus, and others. But those missions were all conceived and built during fatter times at the ESA. Now, budgets are tighter, and the European Space Agency is planning to cut something. Likely candidates are the Herschel and Planck astronomy satellites, which are already a year behind and over budget. The ESA's planning committee plans to make the decision sometime in 2006. As NASA's Stardust spacecraft gets closer and closer to returning to Earth, mission controllers are learning from the crash of the Genesis spacecraft in 2004. The Genesis Mishap Investigation Board quickly determined that the crash was caused by gravity detection switches which were mounted upside down. This caused the parachute not to deploy, and the capsule returned at faster than expected speeds, landing in the Utah desert. The Stardust spacecraft was built before Genesis. In fact, Genesis was built along similar designs. However, Genesis was more complicated than Stardust, and because of that extra complication, the gravity switches needed to be repositioned. Stardust mission controllers believe that Stardust's gravity switches are mounted correctly. However, they are coming up with contingency plans just in case. A Proton M launch vehicle carrying the AMC-23 telecommunications satellite lifted off from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan at 0228 GMT Thursday. AMC-23 will be parked at 172 degrees west longitude, and over its 20 KU band transponders will provide broadband internet access to airliners crossing the Pacific using the Boeing Connection System. Over its 18 C-band transponders, it will provide normal broadcast television services. The European Space Agency's first Galileo positioning satellite was launched aboard a Soyuz launch vehicle from the Baikonur Cosmodrome on Wednesday. The Galileo system is the European Space Agency's answer to the U.S. GPS system and will provide positioning services to users around the world, including those in Europe. Galileo will improve coverage in northern Europe, where GPS coverage is currently spotty. It will also increase the accuracy of the current GPS system to about a resolution of 3 feet. Consumers should be able to buy Galileo-compatible receivers sometime in 2008. In a related story, a Proton-K launch vehicle carrying 3 Russian GLONASS positioning satellites lifted off at 0507 GMT on Sunday. The GLONASS system is the Russian answer to the U.S. GPS system and will provide accurate positioning, velocity, and timing information to users around the world, including the Russian armed forces. Astronomers have used light echoes to determine the ages of 3 supernovas. All 3 explosions occurred centuries ago, with the oldest occurring about 600 years ago. However, astronomers hadn't known exactly when they occurred until now. This isn't the first time light echoes have been seen. However, it is the first time that light echoes have been used for this purpose. Researchers at NASA have observed an impact of a small meteorite on the surface of the moon. The explosion was recorded on video and appeared as a bright flash which diminished slowly over the course of 5 frames. Each frame lasted 1/30th of a second. The meteor was thought to be about 4 to 5 inches across, but the crater it created was about 10 feet wide and about 4 to 5 feet deep. NASA considers these observations to be important in the work to put astronauts back on the surface of the moon by 2018. And that's all I have for this week's edition of The Space Report. Please visit www.thespacereport.com for space news updated every weekday, and feel free to send me your comments, suggestions, and story ideas by email to chris@thespacereport.com. You've been listening to The Space Report on This Week in Amateur Radio. I'm Chris Peterson. KG0BP.
The deadline for applications to participate in WRTC 2006 has been extended until January 20, 2006. So far, more than 80 participant applications have been received. WRTC 2006 will take place July 7 to 10 in and around Florianapolis, Brazil. The Global Amateur Radio Contesting Competition is held in conjunction with the International Amateur Radio Union, or IARU, HF World Championship. Although WRTC rules differ in some respects from those of the IARU event, and scoring is separate. Two-person teams from all over the world would compete for gold, silver, and bronze medals. WRTC stations run 100 watts and have comparably modest antenna systems, typically a dipole for the low bands and a tri-band Yagi for the higher bands.
And finally this week, satellite radio seems to be making great strides over the technology currently in place on the standard broadcast band in North America. XM Satellite Radio has announced that they'll begin broadcasting select music channels in 5.1 surround sound, the first time, according to the SatCaster, that a radio company has broadcast in 5.1 for 24 hours, 7 days a week. We previously reported that both XM and Sirius devoted a channel to surround sound experimentation a while ago. Now, XM is expanding that concept using surround technology from Neural Audio Corporation. The new offering of 5.1 surround on XM is called XMHD Surround, with discrete channels of digital audio encoded and decoded with neural audio technology. Beginning in March 2006, XM will broadcast the freeform music channel Fine Tuning and the classical pops music channel XM Pops in XMHD Surround. XM will also broadcast a variety of shows and live music performances at its studios in surround. XM manufacturing partners such as Denon, Onkyo, Pioneer Electronics, and Yamaha will introduce home audio systems that can play the Neural XM HD Surround in 2006. Listeners can hear any of the surround broadcasts on existing mono, stereo, or any matrix-style receiver.
Many of the news and information items heard on This Week in Amateur Radio have been provided by the American Radio Relay League's ARRL Letter and Audio News Service, AMSAT, the Radio Amateurs of Canada, the Amateur Radio Newsline, Australia's Q News, the RSGB, NASA, the New Zealand Association of Radio Amateurs, amateur radio websites around the world, news sources on the internet, and the packet bulletin board systems of the United States and Canada.
Transmission and production expenses for today's edition of This Week in Amateur Radio was made possible by our staff and crew at our headquarters in Albany, New York. Remember that out-of-pocket expenses to cover production of this weekly bulletin service by our staff is a limited resource. If you value our service to keep you up to date on all the latest amateur radio news, please help support us. Although we can't tell you how to support us on the air, you'll find all the information you need at our website at twiar.org. That's www.twiar.org.
This Week in Amateur Radio is produced by Community Video Associates, Incorporated. If you'd like to become an affiliate, submit news items, become one of our regular voice columnists, send us comments about this weekly amateur bulletin service, or to help support us, please write to us at P.O. Box 30, Sand Lake, New York, 12153. We can also be reached by telephone weeknights at 518-283-3665. You can reach any staff member or on-air personality by sending email to their amateur call sign at twiar.org. For program audio, archives, and other useful information, please visit our website at www.twiar.org. Our snail mail address to write us or to contribute to our support fund is P.O. Box 30, Sand Lake, New York, 12153. This Week in Amateur Radio is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike license. Visit our website to view a copy of this license. Now for the staff of This Week in Amateur Radio, this is Chris Perrine, KB2FAF, saying 73 until next week. This Week in Amateur Radio is copyright 2006, Community Video Associates, Incorporated, all rights reserved.